I just wanted to make a couple of comments about the shackling issue, since that's sort of been a passion of mine for a number of years. Fortunately, in Rhode Island, we're now, because we're a very small state, so we're able to make, I think, some strides in some areas, challenges in other areas, unlike some of the larger states like New York, for example. those of you who are interested in the shackling issue, if you go to the Rebecca Project for Human Rights, they have really been very instrumental in working nationally and on a state level, and will work with individual states. In Rhode Island, for example, they were able to work with me and our Rhode Island State Nurses Association, and then we pulled in ACLU to have legislation passed. And I think, Lori, some of my other friends, are we up to 17 states now with legislation?
18.
Okay.
Not including Massachusetts, if you want to talk to me.
I know. So about 18 states, that's big progress, yet we still have a long way to go. So in our state, again, because we're very small, we've been able to really work very closely with Women and Infants Hospital, where all our women deliver. And so we've been able to go into the hospital and educate them about working very closely with women and being able to maintain attachment between their baby and them. And also that if they're fully aware, the physicians, nurses, social workers are fully aware of the standards that we have, and if there is any violation of those standards, they have immediate phone contact with our deputy, Donna Collins, who's just really been phenomenal. So we've been very fortunate so far, not that we're not without our problems, and that you're probably saying, why is she talking about this? I'll get to that as quickly as I can, but I just have to mention a couple of things. We've also been able to support breastfeeding. So right now, I know I think it's because we're a small state, so we've had four women now who have been able to successfully breastfeed while in prison and have correctional officers on board and have developed a policy. If any of you are interested in our standard related to breastfeeding, I'd be happy to send that to you. You can also get it from our deputy, Donna Collins. So in addition to my work with pregnant women, again, I have multiple roles in the Rhode Island State Prison where I provide clinical services one day a week, and see all the pregnant women, collaborate with our parenting coordinator, our nurse practitioner, the physician who's there. So we have a really pretty tight team. And out of my work there, working with pregnant women, actually the use of mindfulness started with them. That a couple of years ago in my clinical role, given their level of anxiety, et cetera, I started doing individual work as a psychiatric nurse with them using a CD player and relaxation. So that's kind of how this all sort of burgeoned into what it is now. So I can move forward from, excuse me, disclaimer, given the time frame. Our two presenters already did a wonderful job looking at the national demographics, so I can sort of go on from there. Oops, sorry. In addition, of course, I think you're all very familiar with additional stressors of prison life, the routine. I was really struck this week when I went to see one of our women who had an 8-year sentence and is now in our minimum security. And one of my undergrads, I have undergrads, graduate and doctoral students there. One of my undergrads came with me to see her. And what she was so struck by is how much anxiety she's having from being in a minimum security facility, coming from a medium maximum security. And that just struck her because for this student, as many of us might think, going from such tight security to less security is like, wow, a breath of fresh air. And she even talked about how she had her first piece of watermelon in 8 years. But the routine, especially for a long period of time, can lead to this, as you might imagine, a sense of being closely institutionalized and finding it very difficult to step out of that. So fortunately, she's got some time in her minimum security facility now to make that transition. Crowding, as we're very familiar with, the boredom that really occurs as a result of that same routine over and over and over again, and clearly not having as many resources and programs that the men do, which we're all in here continuing to fight. But additional stressors, certainly the number one stressor that the women always talk about with me is that they're separated from their kids and so forth. Lack of privacy, even in the work around the mindfulness, part of our work has been to ask them to keep journals related to when it works, when it doesn't work, what's been effective, what hasn't been effective. But they're always aware and attuned that in a flash, a CEO could come up, there could be a search, and whatever they have could be examined. So even in terms of maintaining their personal thoughts, they're very restricted, and that's an extreme stressor. Witnessing other prisoners being bullied and the ever-changing cellmates that come in and out, particularly for women with long sentences. Again, as was mentioned already, the possibility of women ending up being booked or in isolation, which can be for what many of us consider a very ridiculous reason. And then many times they are, because the security is so tight. And so if somebody's in Medline and they happen to turn around and talk to the woman behind them and that's slowing things up, well, they might get a booking for one night or whatever, right, in isolation for a certain amount of period of time. So there's this sense of always being monitored and feeling a sense of trap, and certainly the issues around tremendous loss and being separated from their children. Our statistics in Rhode Island are the same in that we're about 75% of the women in our facilities are mothers and have been primary caretakers of their children. Fortunately, because we're a small state, they don't have the same total separation as they do in other states of the country, but it still is a big issue. So moving on to the mindfulness. So that started initially working one-to-one, and then women who are there with long sentences, 10-plus years, asked if they could have a special group because they pretty much exhaust all of the programming that's there. So in meeting with them, we did a lot of discussion, and one of the things that they would like to do is to be able to mentor and support women as they come in because of the anxiety that they feel. So we talked about a number of potential avenues for that, and we've now developed a mentorship program that actually was based on the Framingham model, so that's really exciting. And part of the mentorship will be able to use CD players with CDs that we now have from the institute that we're working with, and be able to use those women, particularly in times of great anxiety, to help them sleep. So this is kind of how this mindfulness research has evolved. It's estimated in our facility about 40% of prisoners seek medical consultation for sleep problems as a result of a retrospective chart review, and that they have very frequent visits to the health clinic for persistent insomnia, for anxiety. And when those visits begin to increase, then we know what happens. They see the psychiatrist and they're placed on a variety of meds. So some of the background. Some of the literature that's been written about the benefits of meditation, there's about 400 articles out now that look at the psychophysiological changes that occur during meditative practice, including a decrease in anxiety and stress and an improvement in mood. But there's been no research that I'm aware of, unless something came out the past couple of weeks, that looked at the use of mindfulness training with CDs in prison settings. So how did all this come about? Well, my work clinically, and then this gentleman here on the left, Fleet Mall, some of you may know him. He was in a federal state prison in, I believe, Connecticut for about 15 years. And what got him through that experience was teaching himself relaxation and mindfulness. And he got the nickname of the mindfulness monk, even though he wasn't. But so he started teaching inmates in his own prison. This goes back now about 25 years ago, I believe. And then when he was released, he was really determined to develop mindfulness-based programs for inmates. And so he established the Prison Mindfulness Institute in the state of Colorado. And over the last, I think it's 10 years, he and his, and Kate Crisp, who have worked together, developed this Path of Freedom program, which was very successful in Colorado. They've since moved to Rhode Island, and so I heard of them and met with them, and they started doing mindfulness programs in our women and men's state, in our men's facilities in Rhode Island that anecdotally had a very positive response. So I thought, well, we've been talking about maybe expanding the work with the women in prison and asked them if we could work with them and try to do a feasibility study. Which has been very interesting, lots of challenges, which I'll mention when I get there. So recruitment, we posted a description of the program, the sign-up sheet on our major bulletin board. We had a lot of women with a description of the program, a lot of the women. We started the feasibility study. We're into our third cohort now, and they've been in groups of 15 to 18. Well, we start with 25. They usually dwindle down to about 15 to 18 per cohort that actually stay in the program. After the women's names are on there, I usually take that and I speak with our clinical social worker that we're very close to, just to make sure that there would be some potential issues with any of the women, and if there are, then I meet with them personally and explain to them why they're not eligible at this point in time, and then I meet with them to obtain informed to discuss the research and informed consent. So what we developed, or have been trying, underlined, underscored, and bold, is a pre-post quasi-experimental design. We administer four instruments 1 to 2 weeks before the 12-week program, 2 weeks after. 1 month after has been totally not successful because of people leaving, moving, shifting, going to minimum, and our numbers are so low that we're not going to be using that data. Four instruments I administered, we're looking at stress, depression, anxiety, and sleep. You're probably all familiar with these scales. They've been strong reliability, et cetera. Again, 12-week program, 1.5 hours. It's a structured program. They have a workbook. We had a wonderful, wonderful facilitator for our first cohort, Rebecca, who had a lot of experience, and unfortunately now she left the study and she moved back to Colorado, and so that has had a huge effect. As you can imagine, research in prison, I actually am a qualitative researcher, and I'm definitely going back to that because doing this kind of research in prison, I am finding has so many more challenges in terms of, you know, all of the things that you're trying to control. So they have a workbook. Fortunately, it took me about 2 years, myself and my colleagues, including Jennifer Clark, who's a physician I work with, to get permission to use the CDs in the prison. So we're very happy about that. And now it's pretty much part of the culture. Hopefully we won't have a change in wardens, because we all know when that happens, things can just really can have a very, very difficult impact. So they have a CD player and they have CDs, and the CDs, it's really pretty neat. I wanted to share with you a CD, but if you would like a CD, I'll give you the information for the Prison Dharma, Prison Mindfulness Group, and they'll be happy to send you one. So they have a focus of each session, and they have certain meditations that they practice in the sessions, in the 1.5 hour session, and then those sessions are also on their CD, so that in between, so if you've got, you know, the program runs Thursday, so between this Thursday and next Thursday, they can practice, which makes a lot of sense. As we know, any of us who do yoga or meditation, we know that without consistent practice, one day a week is not going to go very far. Thank you. So they've tailored the meditations to what the focus of the session is. And the women really, that's anecdotal, that's a lot of the feedback that I get is they really, really like it. And when they're finished with the study, they've been asking, their 12 weeks, they've been asking to keep it. And of course, we're not able to do that yet, but I think that speaks to how it has really helped them. Some of our assumptions about mindfulness, that meditation, mindfulness practice are powerful tools, we know that, can train your mind to be peaceful. So we're also looking at not just the anxiety that comes from being in prison, but all of the stuff, teaching them how to use these tools when they're in Medline, when they're in the cafeteria, when they're anywhere where their anxiety begins to build because of what's going on, and to use that so they don't verbally respond in a way that's going to get them in solitary confinement. So it's used in a number of very practical ways that's embedded in throughout their day. Demographics and of 18, you can see what's up here. Most of them had a psychiatric diagnosis, which has already been discussed, 14 out of 18. And their diagnoses, they had usually 2 out of 3 of them. Most of them had like a combination of depression, anxiety, and PTSD, you know, what you might really expect. And also had very severe medical diagnoses, diabetes, asthma, what was already discussed in terms of that they have significantly higher medical diagnoses than women on the outside and also men, incarcerated men. So we were very excited about our initial cohort, where we had significant statistical results on the 3 scales of stress, anxiety, and depression, pre and post. That's only based on an N of 18. Our sleep quality scores, though, had the opposite effect. I think part of that's related to the questionnaire itself is very cumbersome. And I saw that as we were analyzing the data, so that has not been a good instrument to use, the Pittsburgh sleep inventory. We were hoping that from this feasibility study that we would be able to use more physiological measures and also have bracelets now that actually can measure the quality of sleep and so forth, but that's going to require a lot more money, and we'll see what happens. So let me get down to the challenges, because that's the big piece. You can look at the slides and see all the information about it, but the challenges in trying to implement this kind of a study are enormous. Space is an ongoing issue. 2 minutes, thanks. Unexpected lockdowns that then might have a session that's delayed, and so it's going to be held later on, so you don't have the same one. So maintaining that continuity of, you know, the structure, even though we have the structured program, there's so many interruptions that can occur that you have no control over, which has made this extremely difficult. And even though we have statistical results, positive statistical results, to be honest, and I will be, I'm not sure that I totally trust them. They look good on paper, and you can certainly send them off to try to get another grant, but I'm not totally sure that I trust them, mainly because there's so many things that can happen that can alter how these women are, or how anyone is going to fill out these questionnaires. It could have had a tremendous effect, and that in the morning that they're taking their, you know, they're filling out their scales, they just find out that they lost their parental rights. I mean, there's just so many variables, distractions, that even though we've educated the COs and they've been very good in working with us, there's noise, there's distractions, the lights go out, the air conditioning stops in the summer. There's, again, just to sort of give you a sense of the challenges. Batteries, now I didn't expect that was going to be an issue. Because I have two lieutenants, I have somebody on each shift that has those batteries that nobody can have access to but them. So we thought we had our bases covered, but nobody, including myself, thought about when when one of those lieutenants went on, was sick for 3 days, and then the women asked for batteries, and there was nobody to give them the batteries. So all of these, all of the minutia that comes with doing this kind of study. So I'm going to end here. Thank you for your presence, and looking forward to your, the next presentation.